you can have access to a market without physically having to be there or be a resident of said country.
Yeah, I think we're seeing probably a really interesting competitive dynamic that will play out in the global marketplace.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sand Hill Road.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You're listening to sounds from Estonia's Restoration of Independence Day. The former Soviet territory is celebrating 30 years since it emerged from the Iron Curtain. Estonia is a country of 1.3 million, making it about the size of San Jose, Silicon Valley's largest city. Do you work for the government?
Yes, I work for Estonian government because...
That's Estonian government official Katrin Vaga speaking to me from the capital, Tallinn, about a three-hour ferry ride south of Helsinki, Finland. Now, that's if you want to live in Estonia. If you want to base your company in Estonia, you can work there virtually through something called an e-residency.
Because we have almost completely digital society. You can establish a company in Estonia. It gives you access to European Economic Area, basically European Union countries, to do business, to have partnerships, to work as a freelancer. And it's very easy to administrate your company because it's all online. We really started from the blank page and established, it was a political decision and they worked together with the private sector. So we established the practices that were, step ahead already.
Tallinn is a good example of what sociologists and futurists call a smart city. More than just coordinated traffic lights or eco-green street lamps, smart cities have forward thinking, modern policies, and progressive rules.
You know, I think what we're seeing is tech speeding up changes that were already underway before the pandemic. I'm Jess Northend. I'm policy lead at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change.
I spoke with Jess and her colleague Benedict about the future of cities.
I'm Benedict Maconcuni. I'm the Deputy Executive Director of Technology and Public Policy at the Tony Blair Institute.
Together, they're pushing for cities and governments to develop policies that will allow the world and business to come together. More work, more globalization. So we talk about jobs moving away from places like London and Silicon Valley with all the technology. But really, the job, in a sense, stays in that city. It's the person that moves away. And that really occurred to me when I read an article in the Wall Street Journal by Catherine Bindley. She writes, in the short term, the democratization of tech jobs is broadening Silicon Valley's reach and influence rather than diminishing it. Longer term, companies in smaller hubs are hoping the current pinch is temporary and that eventually they'll have access to the new tech migrants, especially if larger tech companies start reversing work-from-home policies, easing their labor shortage, and enjoying a livelier tech scene and the venture capital that comes with it. That's an interesting way of looking at it, that the talent still fundamentally works in these large hubs.
Yes, I think that's right. And actually, you know, colleagues in the US may have seen this happen a little bit over the past year, but the complexity of what happens when the place that you work is different to the place where you're physically located, in terms of filing taxes and all of those other things that we all have to do. And actually, you know, we have a state that isn't often hugely well equipped for this kind of mobility that we're now seeing. But I think there's also a couple of really interesting things that jurisdictions and cities and states can do to strengthen the kind of support infrastructure that they put in place to attract those anywhere jobs. I mean, one is childcare, and President Biden is at the federal level doing, trying to make headway on this in terms of the American Families Plan. But other things that are incredibly important, like broadband speeds, solid housing stock, all of the kind of nuts and bolts that you would expect to give people a high quality of living, are really, really incredibly important still, and give those kind of smaller cities an opportunity to attract tech migrants if that's what they're trying to do.
And Benedict, it's my understanding that the state of Vermont is doing some of that. They are encouraging people, you know, work for whatever company you want to. It doesn't have to be in Vermont, but come live in Vermont.
Yeah, I think we're seeing probably a really interesting competitive dynamic that will play out in the global marketplace, in competing for labor in very different ways today. And I think, you know, that sort of remote first point, which, you know, I think companies like Coinbase and some others in Silicon Valley have gone to, you know, are really sort of pushing on the frontiers of how this can work, that sort of decentralized, distributed workforce. I think the question on a lot of this stuff, I mean, you've seen them, the sort of potentially the old legacy firms to some degree of high income talent, of sort of, you know, the investment banks, such as JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, saying, you know, it's all office. You're probably seeing a bit of a natural experiment play out on what this actually means as well. And I think one of the questions that we've, you know, just from a sort of, you know, even from as a business perspective that you might even have is like, can innovation in and of itself and creativity maintain in a sort of distributed workplace? I mean, I think I always think back to that sort of Richard Hamming essay on the open door and how it's actually a state of mind. And actually, do you begin to lose touch with those sort of creative points of friction if you don't have those kind of agglomeration effects, which you'd get through proximity? But, you know, I think Jess really sort of plays this out, and, you know, really importantly, and what the policy questions might be around this, because if anybody's also set up if you're domiciled in one place and you've got a headquarters in another, plus you might want to be then taking on a worker in another place, there come a lot of legal and tax implications around this. And I think the complexity of business in a distributed way and the decentralized element of it are a lot more profound than we sort of originally kind of think in these early days of this grand natural experiment of remote working.
And Jess, I think that, you know, workers, when we were faced with this idea, you're going to go home, you're going to connect to the office virtually, workers figured it out fairly quickly. I think companies figured it out fairly quickly, but maybe municipalities and governments are a little bit behind the curve on this. I don't mean with government workers. I mean with the infrastructure of doing this.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, in some respects, this is all an incredibly new trend that we're really starting to work through. And so I think we will start to see some jurisdictions, some governments starting to do some really interesting experimentation around all of this. And we're seeing that in a couple of countries, particularly in parts of Europe, that are now experimenting with e-residency, where you can have access to a market without physically having to be there or be a resident of said country. And I think we're going to see more and more of that over the next couple of years as, you know, more of these anywhere jobs are created and as people really start to, you know, experiment with their own futures in terms of where they want to be based and the companies that they want to work for.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax.
the way car buying should be.
Estonia did that. It has an e-residency, which is hard for me to get my head around. But and it made me think of Brexit, because if someone thought you could protect UK jobs by leaving the European Union and stop, say, an Estonian from, putting an English plumber out of work in England, anywhere jobs might mean an Estonian will take somebody's accounting job in Britain.
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think obviously some of these jobs are kind of, they're sticky, right? You know, as you say, like, a plumber's probably not going to be replaced by someone with an e-residency anytime soon. But, I do think at that sort of top end of the knowledge economy, I do think we will begin to see that kind of competition. I know that the UK has recently, made some adjustments around, going very much to the high, the high end of the market with people that have studied at what they would define as sort of world-leading universities. But I think, part of the sort of e-residency and sort of kind of more, sort of distributed and sort of networked ability that the internet gives you means that more nations will, I think, begin to deploy that. That said, I do think that sometimes, you can go for those slightly utopian ends of where technology can get you. And I think it could, could be fantastic if you could do your job on a beach in, the Seychelles while you might be, working for a British company. But I do think that, the other elements that actually make, labour markets less flexible to some degree still remain. People like to be near their family. People like to, be near, their sort of, activities, whether that's sort of playing football or, the community-based aspect of this is also quite a very strong pull and means that, as much as sometimes you can have very large degrees of labour market flexibility, actually often the sort of very human components can, mean that they, end up sort of being, very sort of settled in where they might begin to work from. Needless to say, if sort of high value paying jobs as well do crop up from around that, well, they're entirely remote, you might be able to then have the benefits of your sort of local community whilst also earning a sort of a global living.
We think about all of this as a win-win. Let's use a random example of a Facebook worker who moves and takes that grant to work in Vermont. Everyone wins. Facebook keeps its talent. The worker enjoys living in Vermont at a lower, cost of living. Vermont wins because it has a tax-paying citizen. Who loses when we have these anywhere jobs and this globalization of jobs?
I think still probably the biggest element, and I agree there's a lot of benefits that come out of this. I think where you will begin to see some of the losers is depending on, it's all about the shape of the jobs as well, and this is the broader sense, right? And this is always the sort of the key question I think we get through with the technology, which is, the more that sort of jobs and value are created at that high end of the market, you need to see, more and more sort of be created down the chain. And in that Vermont situation, I think you will see strong multiplier effects, which mean, that, the person that has a high salary might be able to, stimulate local business as long as you have enough of them. But you obviously need that sort of demand side. I think, in the broader sense, the bits that are still the worry from policymakers' perspective are, the displacement at the lower end of the market, whether that is also then compounded on a sort of a more global scale, particularly in countries which are, down the, low and middle income countries. But I think in this situation, you could, it could see strong multiplier effects that ripple through. But, again, it will need enlightened policymakers to be able to to make that sell and to make that pitch. And again, sort of going back to what Jess said, I think on this, the other point is that you need that infrastructure to be able to do that. And if you don't have that infrastructure, you're very unlikely to be able to attract those kind of workers to do it on a sort of fully remote scale. So I guess in some ways the losers are the people that don't have the infrastructure yet, and that's why we need to really work hard on ensuring that all countries have the infrastructure that enables them to be able to compete at that kind of level in the global market.
And Jess, are there actionable things that cities and states can be doing beyond infrastructure? I mean, the need for broadband, if you're going to have, internet virtual workers, that's baked into that. But are there other things that cities can be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there are some really interesting needs around childcare, which we've talked about a little bit, and some of these things that are being increasingly recognised by policymakers at the federal level, you know, the institutions of the state that mean that people can work full time, return to work, wherever that might be. I think there's also a lot as well around, you know, the kind of quality of life indicators. I mean, one of the things that we're observing is that, as we've talked about, not all jobs will be anywhere jobs. You know, there are some where, for example, in the care economy, where obviously that physical proximity is an essential part of the job, but also in quite a lot of leadership roles where you have that mix of, you know, cognitive skills, cognitive expertise, and the EQ that you need to run teams as well. And actually, those jobs are most likely to end up with people being in an office 2-3 days a week and then having a remote mix as well. So actually thinking really smartly about regional transport networks, I think, is incredibly important as people move from perhaps being in a city to being in the suburbs. And as Ben said, just that mix of, you know, the urban mix really starting to change.
And Ben, the Tony Blair Institute is going to expand into San Francisco with a physical location, right? Which kind of, in some ways, counters our discussion. But why come into San Francisco?
We have offices in London, Singapore, Accra in Ghana, and San Francisco. And I mean, the fundamental view of this is that the technical revolution is a global revolution, not just, you know, confined to one geography or jurisdiction. And so to actually begin to tackle these questions, you need to have a quite global purview about how this is all unfolding. The reason for San Francisco, I think, is obviously is one of the centers of the technological revolution. And, you know, still, despite some of this, I think, movement away from the city, you still have, you know, very, very strong tech sector. And, you know, one of the key sort of tenets of our work is that you need to bring together the policymakers and the change makers and those developing the technology to begin to actually deploy these technologies. And so, you know, part of that is actually having some degree of proximity to those building the technologies that we think are changing the world and being able to engage in a sort of productive conversation about how we deploy them so that they can, you know, be as broad-based and equitable as possible.
We need to get together to talk about how to work apart.
Well, yeah. I mean, as I say, I think, you know, you will probably see a stratification of the labor market. And I think, you know, you will see some that can play into this remote first, some that, you know, can't and that will do a hybrid, and, you know, others will, in some degrees, this will be, you know, a degree of choice. Some of it will be a degree of necessity. And I think, you know, the more flexible that you make your labor market in a globalized world, you know, the better the outcomes are, the more that you adapt to the sort of the digital revolution again, so the better your country is going to thrive.
Benedict McCann-Cumey and Jess Northand of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change talking about smart cities. As we leave you this week, let's end where we began, in Estonia and the Independence Day Party. Sandhill Road is produced by Sean Myers under the leadership of Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni. For more interviews with Silicon Valley's most influential entrepreneurs, check me out on TV at Press Here. That's Sunday mornings on NBC Bay Area and everywhere in the world on iTunes and at PressHereTV.com.